520, Unit 6, Georgia from the Roaring Twenties through World War II. The 27 years between the end of World War I and the end of World War II were eventful and difficult for Georgia. Many of these years were marked by a slowing economy that in Georgia began in the early and mid-1920s as farms and cotton textile factories went through the disaste caused by the boll weevil. As the entire country sank into depression in the 1930s, Georgians continued to suffer through hard times. With the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt as President of the United States, policies known as the New Deal began to address some of these problems. In the process, Georgia began the transformation into a more modern state. Agriculture became more mechanized and diverse, towns and cities grew, and modern conveniences such as electricity were no longer limited to just the cities. Equally important to Georgia's transformation was the state's role in World War II. Thousands of Georgians served in the military on faraway battlefields. In addition, Georgians on the home front worked in shipyards, defense plants, and military bases to provide the labor that kept the troops trained, transported, and supplied. By the end of the Second World War, most Georgians were living quite differently from the way they had only a generation earlier. This unit examines how and why these important changes came about, the effect of national and international events on the state, and the role of Georgia in the nation during these important decades. Page 522 is a focus on the reading skill, distinguishing fact from opinion. Page 523 contains signs of the times on population, music, education, entertainment, and science. Page 524, Chapter 21, The 1920s and the Coming of the Great Depression. Chapter Preview, Terms, Assembly Line, Installment Plan, Boll Weevil, Stock Market, Great Depression, Purchasing Power, Surplus, Entrepreneur. People: Henry Ford, Thomas Hardwick, Ben Epps, William Hartsfield, Marcus Garvey, Oliver Hardy, Gertrude Ma Rainey, Clifford Walker, Julian Harris, Richard Russell, Eugene Talmadge, Bobby Jones. As U.S. soldiers returned from the battlefields of Europe in 1919, many people wondered what the future would bring. Some hoped for a time of stability and safety. After years of progressivism and war, they had tired of constant change. That desire to keep things the way they were, or in some cases, to return to the way things had been in an earlier time, was strong. The conservative politics of the 1920s and the efforts to resist some of the cultural changes reflected the hope of what incoming President Warren Harding called normalcy. Modernization, however, continued in spite of efforts to hold it back. New technology became more affordable and impacted everyday lifestyles throughout the country. Urbanization went on at an even faster rate. The economy of the 1920s seemed to thrive as big business grew even bigger. Consumers bought cars and appliances and other labor-saving devices for their houses. But problems in the economy that few leaders paid attention to eventually caused the good times to collapse, ushering in the worst economic crisis the United States had ever faced, the Great Depression. It took years of reform and another war to bring this economic downturn to an end. With farmers in trouble throughout the 1920s, Georgia and other southern states had economic problems earlier than other areas. For them, the crisis only got worse after 1929, when the Depression became a reality for much of the country. Page 526, Section 1, Modernization and Change. As you read, look for changes in transportation, cultural changes, resistance to change, terms, Assembly Line Installment Plan. The 1920s was a period of continuous change, even though many did not want more change. In the growing towns and cities, the impact of new technology was felt by more and more people as new goods and devices that had once been bought by only the wealthy became more affordable and available to the middle class. People's homes had electricity and indoor water supplies. Electricity brought more conveniences to the household. Middle-class homes had washing machines and electric irons, saving women hours a week in doing laundry. Water heaters brought hot water straight from the faucet. For Southern families, electric fans were welcome during the hot and humid summers in this period before the spread of air conditioning. Telephones kept families and friends in touch with each other, even though many households shared telephone lines with their neighbors. Automobiles made it easier to visit in person, to get to work, and to travel for fun. Life was becoming more convenient and opening up time and opportunities for leisure and recreation. In the countryside, farm people still pumped their water up from wells or hauled it from nearby springs or creeks. They had outhouses rather than indoor bathrooms and cleaned their clothes on scrubbing boards. Electricity had not come to most farm homes, so bedtime was shortly after dark to save on the cost of lighting with kerosene lamps. With no radio, poor farmers had little access to information. They continued to live much as their ancestors had for generations. Not everyone welcomed change. In fact, many Georgians thought it was coming too fast. Some worried about the morals of young people exposed to jazz, new dances, and silent movies. New theories and discoveries in science seemed to question long-held beliefs. As people left the countryside for the city, change seemed to be threatening the rural way of life most Southerners had so long cherished. Those who wanted to maintain the traditional ways often resisted the new ways and ideas. While most resistance was in writing and words, some went to greater extremes. Urbanization. Throughout Georgia, more people were living in cities and towns. Atlanta's city leaders had a clear vision of Atlanta becoming the major city of the South. In 1925, the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce established a campaign to promote and advertise the city in business and other magazines throughout the country. That fall, Atlanta businesses contributed money for the advertising, and Ford Atlanta was launched. In February 1926, the first ad appeared in the Saturday Evening Post. The group wanted to convince businesses throughout the country to use Atlanta as the center for their goods in the South. Ford Atlanta promoted Atlanta as a center of transportation with railroads and trucking. From Atlanta, goods could be shipped to other parts of the South. They also stressed the non-union workforce, low taxes, and a good climate. In the first year, the campaign was so successful that they decided to extend it through 1929. By the end, over 700 companies providing thousands of jobs had moved to Atlanta. They included factories such as General Motors and regional headquarters such as Sears Roebuck. Large businesses were not the only groups migrating to the South. Some of those attracted to southern cities were families who had immigrated from southern and eastern Europe to the northern United States in the late 1800s and early 1900s. The milder climate of the South appealed to many families who found communities in Georgia and other southern states that provided opportunities for family businesses. Americans of Italian, Greek, and Eastern European heritage opened small businesses such as restaurants, grocery stores, hardware stores, and other retail establishments. They brought a diversity of religious faiths with them, including Catholic, Greek Orthodox, and Judaism. They introduced new foods and customs. Transportation. Railroads still carried people and goods in Georgia. However, more and more families began to purchase automobiles. By World War I, Henry Ford was able to make cars cheaper by mass-producing automobiles on a moving assembly line. An assembly line is a series of stations of workers, machines, and equipment, at which people and machines add to or assemble the parts of a product. General Motors and Ford made it easier to buy their automobiles by offering installment plans for their purchase. These plans allowed consumers to make regular payments for the cars over a period of time. Riding in an automobile was quite an adventure. In many areas of Georgia, the decade began with few paved roads, so a ride could be bumpy and dangerous. In the early 1920s, Governor Thomas Hardwick supported a small tax on gasoline that the state could use to pay for paving roads. Cities began to pave some of the major streets within their borders. Many roads, however, were still dirt when the 1930s began. For Georgia, the lack of good roads on which to transport their crops and goods made it harder to make economic changes when the Great Depression began. Another symbol of the New Age was the airplane. Airplanes had been around for almost two decades and had been used in World War I. Georgia had experience with airplanes even earlier. In 1907, Ben Epps, at the age of 19, had flown the first plane in Georgia in Athens. In 1911, the Wright brothers had established a flight school on the old field of Camp McKenzie in Augusta. Aviation developed quickly during World War I. In the 1920s, air transportation of people and goods came more into commercial use. William Hartsfield, an alderman and elected city councilman in Atlanta, helped to establish an airfield in Atlanta and worked to make Atlanta an aviation center in the South. In 1927, a young pilot who made his living flying airmail stunned the world when he flew alone without stopping from the United States to France, the first solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean. Charles Lindbergh had actually made his first solo flight in Georgia. In 1923, he had been learning to fly, and he came to Souther Field near Americus to buy a surplus World War I Curtiss biplane. While there, he went up alone for the first time. Georgia got to honor the hero pilot when he returned to Georgia at William Hartsfield's invitation. He landed at Candler Field in Hapeville, which became an airport used by the U.S. Postal Service for airmail. Women and African Americans. The 1920s was a time when women continued to move into new roles. Georgia women could and did vote, as did women in other parts of the country. As education and nursing had grown, more and more women had gone into those fields. Many town and city libraries also had female librarians. Some even went into fields that were usually for men. In 1921, the Medical College of Georgia admitted its first woman, Laurie Florence, from Athens. Able to support themselves, some young women moved to cities and lived on their own for a while before marrying. These independent young women got the nickname flappers. They often cut their hair in a short style called a bob. This was a big change from the previously acceptable fashion of long hair pulled up or back in a bun. Dresses no longer came to the floor, but were hemmed at the knee. Some dresses also had no sleeves, showing bare arms for the first time. While these styles were popular, some Georgians believed they were not proper. That did not stop some young Georgia women from adopting the flapper style. During the 1920s, African Americans in Georgia continued to lead the state. African Americans had taken part in the country's efforts in World War I and hoped that their sacrifices might bring more equality. Thousands had left for factory jobs in the North right before and during the war. Discouraged by continued segregation and the activities of the KKK after the war, African Americans left Georgia and the other southern states. They went north looking for better access to jobs, better pay and educational opportunities, and the chance for more civil rights. Some African Americans in both the North and the South were attracted to the ideas of Marcus Garvey. The Jamaican-born Garvey had founded the United Negro Improvement Association, which was headquartered in New York. Garvey's ideas included economic progress, pride in being black, and separation from whites. Those ideas had a following among black Georgians, especially tenant farmers and sharecroppers in the southwestern areas of the state. Georgia had over 30 divisions or chapters of the UNIA organization in the 1920s. Cultural changes. Another life-changing device for Americans was the radio. Families wanted to have this talking furniture in their homes. The first national radio network was the National Broadcasting Company, NBC, which began in 1926, followed a year later by Columbia Broadcasting System, CBS. WSB in Atlanta was Georgia's first radio station, coming on the air in March 1922. It was also the first radio station in the South. It was quickly followed by other Atlanta stations and stations in other Georgia towns and cities. For the first time, Georgians with access to electricity could hear the news. Advertising became the major way that radio supported itself, and manufacturers tried to convince radio listeners to buy everything from soap to soft drinks. Americans heard about the same products and became more alike by buying them. Sports games were broadcast over the radio, making it possible for fans to follow their teams even if they could not go to the stadium or ball field. Movies also became a popular pastime, even though they did not have sound until the late 1920s. Georgians enjoyed one of their own native sons on the big screen, Oliver Hardy. Born in Harlem and raised in several towns including Milledgeville, Hardy went to California where he made dozens of silent films. His first comedy film, made with fellow comedian Stanley Laurel, came out in 1927. Laurel and Hardy became one of the most famous and respected comedy teams in film history. They still have fan clubs around the world. Other aspects of lifestyles changed for men and women. For those who lived in towns and cities and could afford to have a family automobile, dating without chaperones became common among young men and women. In music, the blues of the African-American community gained a national following in the 1920s. Gertrude Ma Rainey of Columbus was a popular blues singer who began recording in the 1920s. Many also liked the new music of the period, jazz. In the towns, daredevils often got into the mood of the Roaring Twenties by performing stunts. For example, in 1927, a young pilot named Sig Smith flew over Broad Street in Augusta with young Agnes Holloman hanging from the wheels by silk stockings. Fortunately, the stunt came off without any accidents. So the 20s brought modernization to Georgia's cities, and they helped usher in new lifestyles. From flappers to dating, jazz to dancing, the culture was changing. In Georgia and the South, this change came more slowly than it did in other parts of the country, but it did come. Political change. The 1920s was a period of political conservatism, not only in Georgia, but nationally. After years of reform during the Progressive Era and the change brought on by World War I, Americans were ready for a period of stability. Republican presidential candidate Warren G. Harding was able to capture that feeling in one word, normalcy. In fact, many wanted to undo some of the reforms of the pre-war Progressive Era, including regulation of big business. Politically, the 1920s saw the beginnings of a generational change in Georgia politics. Tom Watson died in 1922, and Hoke Smith retired from politics. New political leaders were emerging who would be influential in Georgia politics for many years. One of the most important was Richard Russell of Winder. His father was already well known in the state, serving as the Chief Justice of the Georgia Supreme Court. In 1920, at only 23 years of age, Richard Russell was elected to the Georgia House of Representatives. By 1927, he had become Speaker of the Georgia House, serving there until his election as governor. The young Russell won the governor's race of 1930 on a platform of saving money by reorganizing the state government. The next year, The Reorganization Act did just that. Almost 100 departments were combined to create just 19. One area of reorganization was in higher education. All the public colleges and universities in the state came under the governance of a central Board of Regents, who appointed a chancellor to oversee and manage them. Another politician who made his appearance in state government in the 1920s was Eugene Talmadge. He was living in Telfair County when he was elected State Commissioner of Agriculture in 1926 and re-elected in 1928. He used that office to make a name for himself among Georgia farmers. Nicknamed the Wild Man from Sugar Creek, Talmadge became a force in Georgia politics for two decades, having his greatest influence in the 1930s and early 1940s. In general, the 1920s is a period when not much new happened in state government. This is not surprising in a time when the general feeling among most voters and the politicians that further change was not welcome. The growing economic problems, however, had to be addressed. The way things were would no longer be acceptable. Resistance to change. One of the most conservative organizations of the period in Georgia was the Ku Klux Klan. As we saw in the last chapter, the KKK had been refounded in 1915 at Stone Mountain, but its growth had been slow until the war was over. A fear of modernization and the rapid change it brought, plus the new groups with different cultures, made those who believed in the old ways want to control their society. Those targeted by this new KKK were not only African Americans, but also whites who were Catholic or Jewish, and whites who violated the KKK's ideas of what was moral. Through intimidation and violence, the Klan tried to keep everyone in their proper place in society, from burning crosses to burning Catholic churches, from threats to outright violence. The KKK terrorized people. In the 1920s, the KKK expanded beyond the South. By 1922, the Klan had branches in all 48 states, wherever native-born Protestant whites felt threatened by the Catholic and Jewish immigrants who had come to the United States from Southern and Eastern European countries. By the middle 1920s, several million people had joined the KKK nationally, and Georgia had over 150,000 members. In 1922, Clifford Walker, a politician with ties to the Klan, was elected governor of Georgia. That was the group's peak at both the national and state level. By 1930, membership was down to less than 1,500 in Georgia. One of the most outspoken opponents of the KKK who helped bring about their decline was Julian Harris, the editor of the Columbus Inquirer. His stories recounted the Klan's violence and named public officials who were members. His courageous campaign against the organization won him the Pulitzer Prize, the first for a Georgian. Reviewing the section, 1. Define assembly line, installment plan. 2. Who were flappers? 3. What was Georgia's first radio station? Page 533, Georgia Portraits. Gertrude Pridgett Rainey, Mother of the Blues. In 1900, Gertrude Pridgett first sang for an audience at a talent contest at the Springer Opera House in her hometown of Columbus. She was only 14, but her distinctive, powerful voice showed her early talent. In her career, she helped establish the blues as a popular music form. Blues music was developed by African American musicians. Its influences included gospel and work songs. The use of blue or sad notes gives the music its special sound. The subjects of blues songs included the problems of poverty, lost love, and living in the South. By 1902, Gertrude Pridgett had begun singing the blues in touring shows. She was certainly one of the earliest females, if not the first, to do so, earning her the title Mother of the Blues. She continued to tour for over 30 years, taking the blues throughout the South to the Midwest, and even to Mexico. She met her husband, William Rainey, in one of these touring companies. His nickname was Pa Rainey, and after their marriage, she became Ma Rainey. For a while, the Raineys had their own touring company called Ma and Pa Rainey and the Assassinators of the Blues. When she and her husband later split up, she continued to tour on her own. On stage, Ma Rainey was a commanding presence with her flashy clothes and jewelry, but it was the powerful, soulful voice that made her so popular. In 1923, she began recording for Paramount. In 5 years with them, she recorded over 100 songs. She wrote most of her songs herself. The 1920s are reflected in her early recordings, such as Bowweevil Blues and Moonshine Blues. Songs of heartache included Gone Daddy Blues. In 1928, she made her last recording with Paramount. Unfortunately, the quality of the recordings has deteriorated over the years, but the power of her voice still comes through. She continued to tour, but the Depression meant fewer people could afford to come to her shows. She eventually retired from touring and returned to Columbus. Gertrude Rainey had been a good businesswoman while she was earning money. She had bought 2 theaters, which she was able to operate and manage after she left singing. She was only 53 when heart disease took its toll and she died of a heart attack in 1939. Her music, however, lived on. When blues made a revival, her contributions were recognized. She is now in the Blues Hall of Fame, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and the Georgia Music Hall of Fame.